Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Welcome to Word in Your Ear. Our guest this evening, I was just reminiscing with him about one of the last occasions we saw each other was, and when people ask, you know, where were you at the height of video madness in the 1980s? You know, everybody's got their own particular memory. My particular memory was, I think the year 1988.
Yeah.
Was being up a bayou in the backwoods of Louisiana.
Yes.
I think the bayou was actually infested by alligators.
And snakes.
And snakes. Why were we there? Because Level 42 was shooting a video.
Yeah.
And this was in the days when everybody had extraordinary budgets to spend on videos. And I have a memory that all the members of Level 42 were painted blue for the occasion.
Yes.
In order that they should read as black and white on the finished video.
That's absolutely right, David.
And our guest this evening, as always, has a very special place in my heart because not only is he a wonderful musician, but he's also a person who in unfailingly has seen the absurd side of being a musician. Whether that involves, you know, playing in front of huge crowds at, you know, Wembley Arena and so forth, or whether that involves being painted blue.
Yes.
Halfway up a bayou in Louisiana, would you please welcome Mark King?
Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Oof.
Do you remember that occasion, Mark?
I most certainly do, David. Yeah, it was one of the most fun weeks I've had. We were flown out by the record company to shoot two videos, Heaven in My Hands and I can't remember what the other one was. It doesn't matter, really. But the one you were referring to did have us up a bayou, painted blue, all looking like Smurfs, so that the video technique at the time was we would appear as black and white. I suppose it's an early form of blue screen, wasn't it, really? And then they could just lock into the fact we were all painted blue. So we'd be black and white, but there was this incredible New Orleans backdrop, you know, behind us too. But I can remember that sort of between the takes and the bits and pieces. And this actually was the very first time that Gary Husband had played with the band, because Phil and Boone Gould had exited the band only a couple of months earlier. And I think that's why I had such a good time doing this, because to me the relief of actually getting things back and running again was palpable, because, you know, half the creative force had left the band. You know, we were at our most successful at that point in 1987-88. And it was this sort of befuddling, you know, moment of, oh no, what are we going to do? And then, thank goodness, Gary Husband sort of came along and saved us, and the great Alan Murphy, the late great Alan Murphy,
yeah,
unfortunately, came along. And we had another, that's it, we had a new sort of lease of life, and it was very exciting. And of course, the relief always comes out with sort of just huge laughter. And we had a fantastic time, and it was lovely that you were there to share that, actually.
I remember the only thing you ate during that week in New Orleans, you used to live entirely on Domino's pizza,
yes,
which was delivered to your room. You didn't go out carousing at all, did you, really?
No, I was actually, I was dry at that point, and I was dry for 7 years from 1987, the end of the Madonna tour. I'd been invited to a Madonna end of tour party and made a spectacular dick of myself. And
what did you do in particular?
Well, I do remember I had a broken ankle, which just didn't help. I'd broken my foot sort of playing tennis. And so I was walking around with a walking stick, and I had this... I just had too much to drink. And so with the walking stick, I was poking Carvalho and Ruffalo, the Madonna's sort of management. Lawyers and management.
Yeah.
in the chest, saying, what a talented lady she is. And then prodding Sean Penn in the chest, you know, because he very kindly said, Mark, I saw you on TV this morning. He said, you're a funny guy. And I just started prodding him in the chest, going, well, I think you're an effing great actor, mate. You know, you're not as tall as I thought you were, but I'll tell you. And I'm just digging hole after hole after hole. Anyway, this was, and this, the reason, there is some slight sort of, you know, reason for this, and that is because earlier in the day, Polydor had thrown a party for us and Def Leppard. And so we'd been out to this, what was it called? Trader Joe's, where we'd had a party, and it was sort of off we go. So by the time we got back to the hotel at 5:30, Joe Elliott and I were walking into the foyer of this lovely Four Seasons hotel or whatever it was, and Joe just decided to lose it and was violently ill all over this lovely marble floor. And he was so sort of befuddled and embarrassed, he took his own coat off and covered it up. Which thought, it's great, it's like Walter Raleigh.
It's like Walter Raleigh.
That's right, yeah. Over his own spew. Yeah. And I thought this was sort of quite funny. And anyway, then one of Madonna's backing singers or the band come over and said, Mark, hey, come on, man, we're all heading downtown. We're having an after-show party there. So I went, right, let's have this. So walking stick, off I go. And my manager, Paul Crockford, at the time said, don't go, Kinger, don't go, Mark. You know, it's a big mistake. I said, I won't, it'll be brilliant. So he, of course, he's my manager, so he tags along to make sure I'm all right. I'm not sure he wasn't as drunk as I was, actually, at the time. But anyway, suffice to say, we went through this dreadful night, which was great fun, but I just acted appallingly. And the next morning, sort of waking up with that thing of, oh, you know, little bits start coming back to you, and you think, oh no, did I say that? Did I do that? I can't believe. And Crockford saw me at breakfast, and he said, yeah, he said, you're horrible when you're like that. And it just really, really sort of got to me, because the last thing I want to be is horrible to anybody. What's the point? You know, I'm a musician. I'm supposed to make people happy. And so just because I'd had too much to drink to get like that. And I stopped, and I never had another drink for 7 years.
What made you resume?
My current wife, Ria, she just said that an accountant came down to stay for the weekend, like they do, you know.
Yeah. And, when you've got big problems.
Yeah,
that.
No. He said, that was great. And Steve said, bloody hell, Kinger, because he's always very well-spoken, because he was quite a well-off accountant. And he said, bloody hell, Kinger, he said, you should just lighten up, you know. He said, just have a drink, have a puff on a cigarette. And Rhea just said, if you want, go on, Mark. And I just thought, oh, I don't know. And anyway, I did. But I sort of eased myself back into it, because always at the back of my head has been this warning from my manager, Crockford, you know, you're bloody horrible when you're like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you didn't immediately grab a walking stick and start prodding people in the chest.
No, I was fully, ankles were good, you know, it was good. Yeah. And it was strange, wasn't it? Because the culture that we've got in this country with drinking now is, I suppose in a lot of ways you could say it's an embarrassment internationally, because we always make fools of ourselves when we go away on the international football things and, you know, on holiday, you know, in Torremolinos and all this, that and the other. It's like, hey, give us some real beer and that sort of thing, you know, which is, it is embarrassing. But, you know, back then it was, wine was quite a rare thing. There wasn't, you couldn't go down, you know, there weren't majestic warehouses everywhere. And, you know, you could get famously Blue Nun. That was like the choice. Yeah. Black Tower, you know, the choice of white wines at the time and stuff. Yeah. And
very sophisticated.
Goodness, yeah, very sophisticated. Bull's blood, you know, Bulgarian red wine, which was so vile. A bottle would, you would make a bottle last about 4 days.
Yeah.
Just, you know, and you wouldn't know if it's corked or not anyway, because it was just vile from the get-go. So so anyway, that was sort of how I sort of got back into it. And I do, you know, I keep my end of the bargain up now. I drink loads. So,
good. Going back, it's traditional when we do these podcasts that we ask people what kind of music playing equipment was there in your house when you were a child. were there record players? Or?
Yes, there were. And I was lucky having two elder sisters, Belinda and Rachel, who one was a Beatles fan. Actually, they were both Beatles fans, and my mum loved the Rolling Stones. And I tied in completely to the Rolling Stones thing. This is like, I'm talking 1963, so it was the beginning of the whole thing. And there was that Christmas present when the, was it the Dansett record player or whatever it was, came out. And there were sort of three 45s. There were two Beatles records, Love Me Do, I think, and Not Fade Away, a Rolling Stones single. And that was it. And I locked it. And my sister, Rachel, to this day, says, I always liked the Rolling Stones too. And I said, I'm sorry, Rachel, you didn't, you know, you liked the Beatles. Of course, now we all know how great the Beatles are and how great the Rolling Stones are too. My wife just recently went to see them at the O2, and she said it's the best gig she's ever been to, which I found quite hurtful. Yes, yeah, very hurtful. Coupled with, he's so slim. And you go, oh. Yeah, whatever. So,
uncork another.
There was good stuff. And my mum and dad were young. I had young parents, you know. They were married. My mum was 17. My dad was 19 when they got married.
Wow.
Belinda came along and... So, you know, I had these very young, you know, trendy parents, and they loved music, which was fantastic. So there was always, when we sort of got up to the age when I was 8 and we got a radiogram.
This was really?
Stereo had arrived. And I got my first Cream album, and that was the epiphany for me.
Were you allowed to play the Queen album on the radiogram?
Cream.
The Cream, sorry. Were you allowed to play the Cream record on the radiogram?
Well...
Because Mark Ellen's father wouldn't let
him... Yeah, he wouldn't let me because he said it would damage the stylus. Yeah, he said pop music would damage the stylus, can only play classical music.
But that was always...
I kind of believed him for a bit. And then thought, great, pop music, it wrecks things.
Wasn't that the fantastic thing, though, about when the stylus, to check that it was on, you always went...
Yeah.
Yeah, always. It didn't occur... And then, but your friends who are more sort of intellectual would always go... And blow the fluff off.
And if it was jumping, you'd put a pile of coins on top.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And how many Warped Bending albums, you know? I think the McCream albums were sort of Warped. But what I used to do was, it was the same with the drum kit, because I got my first drum kit when I was 9 years old. Mum and Dad were absolutely brilliant at supporting the fact that I just loved this stuff. And my dad, who was a prison officer, he trained as a carpenter and a boat builder in Cowes on the Isle of Wight. And, of course, as soon as he'd finished his apprenticeship, the whole boat building thing shut down. But here he was with three young, very young children, no house. So he looked round and the civil service were offering, because the Isle of Wight has been home to three prisons forever. And they said, join the prison service, you get a house thrown in. And that was what pushed him into it, you know.
Right.
And as he always would later say, that, you know, if I hadn't been doing that nipper, I'd probably been inside prison, you know.
So what was it like growing up on the Isle of Wight when you were interested in music? Did you immediately know all the other people who were interested in music?
No.
Was it an enclosed community?
No, it was tough, actually, because records took that little bit longer... to try and get hold of.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Come across from the mainland.
Yes, you know, and there was almost like a 10-day turnaround. I'd cycle to Newport furiously and say, you know, sort of by this time, say the Mahavishnu Orchestra had come along for me at the age of 14, and I'd cycle in and I'd go to Happy Days Music or whatever it was and say, have you got the new Mahavishnu Orchestra record? I don't know what it's called. I can't remember. And, you know, this guy would go through the Enemy or the Billboard or whatever, and he'd go, yeah, it's called In a Mounting Flame. And I'd say, can you get it in for me? And he went, yeah, I'll do that, you know. He said, can you pay for it? And you go, yeah, of course. And he said, right, it'll be in 2 weeks. You'd have to this agonising period of waiting for 2 weeks. But when that second week came, you know, You jump on your bicycle and cycle the 7 miles into town to get it, carry it home under your school blazer, get home, wow, mum and dad are in, fantastic, radiogram lit up, thump, get it on, full whack, and the opening strains of Meeting of the Spirits starts, which has got to be one of the most enigmatic chord sequences ever. And it was... just heaven.
And you were a drummer then, weren't you?
So, yeah, so I was.
Billy,
yeah.
Was he Billy Cobham?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, 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 Billy
Cobham. So that must have been part of it.
Well, yeah. Like I said, these were real epiphanies for me because I did that thing. Cream had Ginger Baker, you know, the great Ginger Baker, who I've had the pleasure of playing with not too long ago, which was interesting.
I bet.
Yeah, yeah, go on. Tell us about that. We can take a short detour into...
How we can do that.
He's got quite a short fuse, isn't he?
Well, short fuse. you can't get a word out before he's on your back. You know. It was, sadly, Jack Bruce passed away, 2014, I think. And 2015, they had on the anniversary of his death at the Roundhouse in London, Jack's family put together a tribute concert. And, you know, they gave me a call, singing bass player. And they're obviously known I'd love Jack. All my life, and he was my first real influence. Singing bass players were quite rare. I know the McCartney and but it was a rare thing. So yes, and Ginger Baker was my hero, Eric Clapton was my hero, Jack Bruce. Anyway, wind forward then, here I go, I'm a middle-aged man. I just watched this documentary called Beware of Mr. Baker.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic.
Which
attacks the journalist.
This one, yeah, which opens. Yeah. The opening shot is him sort of breaking the nose. Well, funnily enough, with a walking stick. What is it with drummers and walking sticks?
No, it's true.
You see a drummer with a walking stick, guys, just cross the road, right? Anyway, so I get the call to go in, and we're rehearsing at John Henry's, this fantastic sort of historic rehearsal studios in North Severn, just up the road from here. And I'm walked in, and it's great. I had Sunshine of Your Love. We were going to do the first, and that's one of my favourite songs ever, So I bought myself an old Gibson EB3 bass, the same one that Jack used to use, 1969. And so I showed up for rehearsals just in time to see this sort of old gentleman walking across the sort of concourse at John Henry's. And I said, "Mr. Baker, pleased to meet you." And he went, "What?" Hand cupping his ear. Yeah. "What?" He said, "Why are they playing guitar solos? You don't play effing solos. It's a rehearsal. F me. What are they going?" And he sort of waddled off, chewing frantically. And I'm thinking, is he sort of on drugs? Turned out he'd just given up smoking and was going through Nicorettes like they were going out of stock. He had the biggest wad. He looked like an aging hamster. This was followed by this sort of middle-aged blonde lady comes waddling out, and she said, "You sit yourself down, Dad." And I said, "Oh," I said, "how do you do?" I said, I'm playing with your father a bit later on." And she was just about to snarl, and then she went, "Oh, you're that, yeah, I love that. Oh, what's that song you did, Heaven in My, something or other, Oh, I'm very pleased to meet you, Dad. It's him." "What?" Oh my goodness me. Anyway, it was pretty. I didn't realise that that was it. He'd walked out of rehearsal, so I'm just shown up to, right, let's do this. I walk into the room, and there's Phil Manzanera, and there's Ian Anderson, and there's Bernie Marsden. I can't remember all the great guitarists. Now, there's so many amazing guitarists who've shown up to play this thing. Nitin Sawhney was MD. You must forgive me. Vernon Reed from Living Colour, was there. Yeah. Clem Clempson was there. So anyway, I walked in, and they're all looking quite ashen-faced. I said, "You all right, lads?" And they went, "Oh, Mark, that was horrible." He said, "We played a minute and a half, and he just got up, shouted, and stormed out." And so that's Ginge. Ginge. My favourite use of the term Ginger Baker was from Count Arthur Strong, who in one of his radio shows said, it's unthinkable. That's like, what, you can't have them not playing together? Yeah, that would be like Fred Astaire without Ginger Baker.
That's fantastic. Brilliant.
So you started off as a drummer.
Started off as a drummer.
You came to London. You got a job in the musical instrument shop.
Yeah, I did. Charing Cross Road, Macari's Music.
Right.
It was a wonderful place. There was the one shop that didn't sell drums. Every other store had drum kits in, and I went into every one. And they're, no, mate, you know, got a job? No, mate. Got a job? No, mate. No, mate, you know. McCurry's was also known as the Vox Shop. They had a ton of guitars, loads of accordions, which was a bit of a, you know, turn off when you're 19.
Yeah.
And, but it turned out to be, they were lovely. Joe and Larry McCurry were fantastic. Hired me. More as a, what would you call it, an odd jobber, because they'd say, Mark, you could you stick a bit of this, that and the other up? Because I was always quite handy with the hammer and nails and stuff, so I used to put up soundproof booths for them and bits and pieces. You know, keep them away from the till. I think that was the ethos there. But the, it gave me the, this opportunity to sit and watch, because, of course, it's right on Charing Cross Road. All the theatres, you're in the middle of theatre land there, and of course you get these touring American shows have come over, and you get some of the best musicians that just come walking in, fantastic keyboard players, you know, get on the roads and suddenly sounds like it sounds like Chick Corea or Herbie Hancock. And this is right up my street, and you get the old bass player come in and he'd sort of slap the bass, and I'm thinking, what is this? You know, what is this guy doing? Because it looks to me like he's drumming on the bass. So that coupled with, you know, Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays are a bit slow, lots of time.
You've got your interest in Mahavishnu Orchestra and what we would now call jazz rock, I suppose.
Yeah, jazz fusion,
but, there wasn't much of this on television or anything like that. So if you wanted to see how somebody did something, which presumably is really important.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, David, because I'm left-handed. I'm naturally left-handed. I write left-handed. I do most things I leave with my left. But it was only because I'd ever watched musicians playing on TV that it didn't occur to me that you could play drums left-handed. So I set them all up right-handed, which, as it turns out, is quite a good exercise for a young kid to do in terms of independence, because really you want to lead with your left and work that way. But because it seemed to me that I'd never seen anybody set the drums up left-handed. When I saw Phil Collins play left-handed, I was like, what? You know, nobody said you could put the hi-hat over there. You know, this is also because my dad told me that he used to play. He's told me he was a great drummer. He told me he was a great drummer. So when he got the first drum kit, he never actually got on the drums and played. But he set it up and went, there you go, son. And so there it was. It was sort of right hand set up and off I went, you know. But it doesn't matter. When you're a kid, you can do anything, can't you? It just, you suck it all in and do the whole thing.
So you very quickly switched to bass.
Well, it wasn't quick. You know, I'd started drums when I was 9 and now I was 19 in London, so for 10 years. And I was actually pretty good. You know, I could have been a good drummer. You know, my best mate at the time, Phil Gould, who was the first drummer in Level 42, and is an awesome drummer. That's how we became friends, is because we both felt that we were on another level to these guys. And our heroes were the likes of Billy Cobham, Lenny White, Tony Williams, Buddy Rich. And, you know, the lovely thing about the job that I've got is that as the years have passed, Billy Cobham's come in and, you know, played with us 3 or 4 times. We've done a couple of nights at Ronnie Scott's, guesting for Bill Cobham too. And that's a real feeling when you turn up to rehearsals, which Bill doesn't rehearse a lot, by the way, which is another story entirely. But the, you know, he's the most incredible guy at picking stuff up on the fly. But just to suddenly catch myself and look round and go, this is the guy that I was knocking one out about, you know, when I was 14. It was just incredible. I wasn't really.
So how much of it when you were 14 was just that kind of showing off side of it? You know, do you ever have a tennis racket and pose in front of the mirror and pretend you were John McLaughlin or Stanley Clarke or whatever? I didn't,
because the last thing I wanted to do was stand there with a guitar. I wanted to play drums. Right. It really was a passion, you know. It's just that circumstance prevailed. And when... You know, when the band started right at the end of 1979, which incidentally, the reason that me and Mike Lindup and Phil Gould got on so well and met up was because I met Mike for the very first time in Oxford Street and he was carrying a pair of Billy Cobham drumsticks. So the conversation was, oh, yeah, you know. So straight away, that told me. It's like the Masonic handshake.
Was he walking around with these things, hoping to be recognised?
Yes, he was. Not
by another drummer.
No, but it's just like, it's the secret sign, you know. Something under your lapel, sir. What's that? It's a pair of Billy Cobham drumsticks. We're going to get on. Strange, yeah? But that's drummers for you.
Right, right.
When they have London Drum Week, right, there's...
Those who walk around
the park benches are empty. Ow!
Yeah. But you must be a rare case of somebody who started off as a drummer and moved to mastering a kind of...
Well, it's
another
it was,
instrument.
If you sort of go back to when I'd sort of in Macari's and I watched these guys would come in every so often and start playing, you know, and it, like, as I said, it seemed to me like they were drumming on the bass.
Right.
I wasn't too worried about the notes, you know, and my advice to anybody starting is get your right hand going. If you're a right-handed player, make it swing. You only got to grab the strings. You don't have to worry about notes, but you've got to make it go... Get some rhythm going, because that's what makes people dance. That's what makes it sound great. The people that sit there and go, the chord of E is, and they sort of push their fingers around, and then with their right hand that should be making this thing swing, they go... Blank. And it sounds horrible.
That's me.
Straight away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Straight away, they sort of turn themselves off because it even sounds dreadful to them, you know. So the great advice for me is, like, make it swing. So back to the bass playing thing. If you thump with your thumb, like this, and with your left hand, you hammer on. It's a bit like percussion. So... And that's it. That was how I just approached
Brilliant.
Playing the bass.
Brilliant. And when Level 42 first started, what sort of songs... I mean, this is quite early on. We're looking at a picture of...
That's about 4 years ago, I'd say.
What were you playing when you started? Were you doing cover versions or anything like this?
No, we didn't. We never did that. We always... Because we used to rehearse on a Monday evening at the Guildhall School of Music, where Mike Lindup was studying... Phil was studying at the Royal Academy of Music. So these were the guys who'd done it, were doing it the right way.
Right.
Boone, Phil's older brother, and my best friend shared a squat together in Walthamstow. And, fed ourselves every day on Peter's steak pie. And a Cadbury smash, you know, instant mashed potato. Yeah. And that was it. Luxury. That was our contribution to fine living. But the... No, we didn't. We only ever wanted to play our own music, and that was it. And our set list. We had one gig, that our very first ever gig was at the Students' Union Hall at the Guildhall School of Music, and you know Mike had worked it out, and we got this thing, and it was, the set list was funky riff number one, Latin-y vibe was number two, funky bit going into jazz section number three, and it was it. And these are just riffs, which is exactly how the first album came about, because it's really just a series of riffs that we chopped around together that we love playing. We didn't give a monkey's if anybody else liked it, which incidentally at the Students' Union Hall they didn't, because we just got about four bars into number three, the funky bit going into the jazzy bit, and this sort of ginger head bloke came over and went, "That's enough, lads, thank you very much." People can't hear themselves talk, and it was like, "So what, should we turn down?" And he went, "No, just finish." That was that. So that was our first ever gig. But it didn't matter, you know, that when you it was great sitting in listening to Mark Kermode talk earlier on, because that want to be in a band and just playing with your friends is so powerful and so driving. It's very hard to it's very hard to sort of remember a time when it wasn't like that. It was that exciting, and it was that, you know, I didn't care if I didn't have enough money to get home to the squat in Walthamstow. I didn't care if I didn't have enough money for a Peter's pie the next day. All I cared about was that I'd managed to blag a bass guitar off of my friend Martin, and I'd show up at the Guildhall, because incidentally I'd lost my drums. I'd done this is another story, but I'd travelled out to Austria to join a band as a drummer, which is where I thought it was all going to go. And it never happened. And they said, "Oh, well, you know, we're all a bit broke, Mark, but I'll tell you what, we'll give you the money for a ticket home. We'll just hang on to your record collection and your drums." And, you know, me, I'm just a kid from the Isle of Wight. I went, "Thanks, lad, you will send them back, won't you?" And they went, "Yeah, of course. Yes, very soon." You know, and they never did. So 3 months later, I sort of managed to save up enough money to take the train ticket out there. And there were just two of the drums left in this shop window. My record collection was completely gone. And it was sort of with some... Because I was quite sort of tasty back then, physically. So I had no problems walking into the shop and going, oh, you, that's my symbol, give me that, where's the rest of it? And, well, Mark, no, it's I don't know, I don't know what's happening. So I came back all the way from Austria with a symbol stand, a symbol, and like an old snare drum or something. That was it. So my drums were gone. Thank goodness I could fall back on the bass.
And there was an early, yeah, there was an early tour, I think it would have been 81, after you got signed, I think, where you were doing Caister Soul Weekenders.
Yes.
Was that
right?
About 1980. And just describe what those events were like, because I don't know if that kind of thing exists anymore, but it was a big deal at the time.
It was a massive deal. And the thing is, it probably made more sense to me than anybody else that showed up there going, what the hell is this? Because I'd grown up on the Isle of Wight, and my whole playing history, sort of since from the age of 11, when I was playing in Pseudo Foot, which is the band I played in, was playing in holiday camps.
Name of group again?
Pseudo Foot.
Pseudo Foot.
Yeah, okay. That's it. Do you know what that means, don't you?
Go on.
It means something?
It means false foot.
I suppose it does.
Yes, it was just one of those things. I was so excited to be in this band that I had this little wooden cabinet that I bought, because I always remember sort of seeing, see, like backstage on this photograph for the listener at home, we're looking at a photo here, and there's a flight case on the side of the stage. And so from the age of 9, flight cases seemed to be important to me. And Dad had this old medicine chest or something, and I painted it red and wrote Pseudo Foot on it in crayon.
You thought you'd arrived there.
I thought I'd arrived, yeah. I thought I'd arrived.
So when you, I mean, there's always that feeling with Level 42 that they kind of connected with this big audience of kind of people who like going out and dancing.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
Well, we were taken under the wing because Andy Sawyer, our first producer who had Elite Records, he was an independent record label owner, and he worked out of a studio in North London with Jerry Pike, his sort of his mate. And they came along to see us rehearse once. We had about 5 of these funky number one riff, that whole thing again.
Yeah.
None of which impressed them at all, except for one riff that we played, which became the first song called Love Meeting Love. And so he said, oh, we'll record this for you. And that's what they did. It was and my hands are I can so many things. I could go off on a million tangents. It's impossible, especially with early onset, which I'm convinced I've got.
Right. But the Soul Weekenders. Yeah, I mean,
what describe them? Because they sounded absolutely riotous.
It was wild. It was absolutely wild. You know, and they were actually run by the DJs. They called themselves the Funk Mafia, and it was a collection of DJs. Robbie, what's his name?
Vincent.
Robbie Vincent.
Yeah.
There was just that he was sort of like the head man because he had this serious radio show. But then there were all the acolyte DJs around him, and they were the guys that put these gigs together, obviously making a few bob out of it, which was fair enough. But then they get, you know, so they'd hire in the local bands that were happening, like Light of the World and Central Line and Level 42 and Lynx. Shack Attack. So we were all brought along to sort of play, and you'd go up, I don't know, you'd be going on at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, and then you do it again the next night, and everyone would sort of stagger home Monday morning, having sort of kicked off Friday afternoon. These were very, you know, our whole rave thing is nothing new to us because we were living through it. Right back then, you know, but then there's nothing new under the sun, is there? I'm sure Mum and Dad were doing it.
So these are some of your bass heroes we're looking at here.
Yeah,
is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. We're looking at a picture of the great Stanley Clark up the top there. And then next to him is Bootsy Collins. You know, Bootsy was sort of funk personified. And I love the stories of Bootsy, I think, as much as any of his bass lines, is that there's one great quote from him that is that they were touring, they were sort of well into this Into the Jungle groove vibe, and were touring in Germany at the time, and he'd taken a tab of acid, you know, which is never advisable when you're going to go on stage. And he said that during the third song, the neck of his bass turned turned into a python and started attacking him. He said, I just took the bass off and threw it on the floor. He said, I was having no part of that shit. And then he said, needless to say, that ended my love affair with the Godfather of Soul, and he was fired immediately. But Stanley Clarke was just a phenomenon in terms of the technique and, you know, what he started. And that would have been my first experience of hearing someone hit playing with his thumb, and you can see in that photograph there, he's given it some. And as part of Return to Forever, which were the band that came along for me sort of just after the Mahavishnu Orchestra, this opened up a whole other thing, because where I've been focusing on perhaps the drums more, I mean, Lenny White in Return to Forever was just phenomenal. I actually went to his house when I was 17, 1976. Freddie Laker had started this great idea of like cheap flights to America. And I'd written, in 1975, I'd written a letter to Lenny White's house in America, wherever the hell it was, saying, you know, is there any advice you can give me? You know, I'm a young and coming drummer. I love everything you're doing. And I was 16 when I wrote the letter. And a year later, I got a letter back, which was just incredible. I didn't expect to get anything back. And I've still got the letter on my wall at home. It's lovely. And it just says, Mark, thanks for writing to me. It just gave me all this wonderful advice. But it ended with, don't forget, Mark, in life, a man makes his own chances. And then put his address underneath, which I took as meaning, so you should come to my house.
Was he thrilled to see you?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, right, I went, I travelled all the way there, saved up the money, got this cheap flight out there, which wasn't cheap when you're 17, you know, everything's cost a fortune. And I went there and I found his place in Queens, in New York, knocked on his door, and his wife answered. She was so charming. And I said, oh, hello. I said, I'm Mark King from the Isle of Wight. No, nothing. And I said, I wrote to Lenny last year. And she said, oh, sure, yeah, the kid from the Isle of Wight. Yeah, how are you? You know, what can I do for you? And I said, well, you know, is Lenny in? She said, no, he's in California. I said, California? It's like 3,500 miles away. So I think she saw my lips starting to go, you know, and I was filling up. And she said, it's okay, honey. He'll be back in 6 days' time, which is the day before I was due to go home. She said, if you can leave me a number. Anyway, Lenny got back. He called me up. Said, come on over.
Fantastic.
It was amazing. And I went to Lenny White's house and I met, there was him. And he played me the very first hearing. Probably anyone outside of his circle had heard of Tales of the Astral Pirates, which has now been just made. And Don Blackman, the great Don Blackman, who was his producer, was there with him. And he took me into his basement. He spent the whole afternoon with me. And he had this drum kit set up, which didn't sound anything like. It wasn't what I was expecting at all. Because I was going, Lenny, your toms are all high. I said, but the snare's really low. He said, yeah, that's for jazz, Mark. This one's for jazz. And then there was this orange drum kit in the corner, sort of stacked up. And he said, that's Mike Shreve's kit, you know. And all these people, because I'd loved Mike Shreve since I'd heard Caravanserai.
That's amazing.
You know, Santana stuff. What a sweetheart, eh? Absolutely lovely.
So do you ever get anybody turning up at your doorstep?
Oh, yeah. And I go, fuck off. Yeah. I'm not nice like Lenny White is.
No.
I should do it with a walking stick now, shouldn't I?
What? Well, definitely the walking stick. Just one more bass-related question. I can remember in the mid-80s, you know, there was a story presumably invented by a PR that you had your thumb insured for $1 million or something.
£3 million sterling.
Which I'm sure we ran in smash hits. We thought it was a terrific story, but I can't imagine this was true.
It was true, actually. In 87, we re-signed to Polydor Records. And we, you know, we'd done great. 1986, I think we damn near saved Polydor in the UK. I think we were their biggest selling artist, and that's important to them, you know. And of course, they don't know that you're just going to fall off the edge of the world and disappear up your own jacksie. So they figure this is probably a good bet, you know. And so they advanced us this whopping great advance, you know. And just to cover it, they because they knew I had a penchant for chainsaws and tractors and stuff, because I like it. I'm come from farming stock on the Isle of Wight, that's it, you know. So I still do, you know, I build barns and all of that, and I love it. I love being in the garden. But of course, that, you know, leads to like, whoop, there goes a leg. And that's it. And they said, so we'll do it. And of course, it made a good story. But they really did insure it, you know. So
and that was a headline hundreds of times,
oh,
wasn't it?
Was, yeah.
Well, you brought it up.
Yeah.
Still remember it.
That's all it takes, isn't it? To get a load of press.
Absolutely, yes.
It's the one thing everyone knew about Mark King. Oh, everyone say at parties. Oh, he's got his thumb insured for £3 million.
Well, so a journalist recently asked me. He said, "Tell me something that you think people won't know about you, Mark." And I said, "I've got 7 chickens." And it just went dead. It had no effect at all.
No.
Never came out in the article.
No.
So you're better off saying my thumb's insured for £3 million. Yeah. Yeah.
But you had that period, didn't you, in the mid-80s when you were on the giddy carousel of pop stardom, weren't you? You were
we
chart
really did
singles and...
We really did do it. You know, we
What's the most ludicrous thing you did during that time? Was the one moment where you thought, what am I doing here?
More ludicrous than being painted blue.
It would have been 1985, and I've been invited to be part of the Prince's Trust Rock Gala 10th birthday anniversary. And it was Elton John that said, "Yo, you know, get Mark in to play bass." And Eric Clapton was in the band, Phil Collins, Mark Knopfler. It just went on and on and on. You know, the stars that were coming on, Bowie came up and sang a song with Mick Jagger. George Michael came on and sang. It was just this heady thing. But that moment of walking up, and of course, Midge was MD in the whole thing, and is one of the reasons we became such good friends. But standing, waiting to be announced on stage in Wembley Arena, and looking down the steps, because obviously the bigger the star, the later you come on. And so I was sort of on second, I think, after the announcer, who did his Harry, you know, Huey Green thing of please welcome on stage, and whoever he was. And next up, Mark King. And so but before that bit, I looked back down the steps, and there was Elton John and Eric Clapton and, you know, Phil Collins and Mark Knopfler, and everybody looked scared to death. And I just thought, this is amazing, because we all had this feeling of, what are we doing here? And that goes, as soon as the place goes, something happens inside of you, and you go, yeah, this is it, this is mine, I'm meant to do this, this is what I'm meant to do. But for that brief moment before that happened, the look of terror in everybody's eyes was palpable, you know. You might as well have put a gun out and shot, because that's what they were expecting, you know.
So do you find the nervousness, it's quite interesting this, do you find the nervousness never goes away?
No, not ever, David. You know, we're out on tour again in a couple of weeks' time. And I'm already getting the dreams. I have nightmares. You just have this lead up to the nightmares where you walk out and there's 3 people in this massive hall. And they're not really paying attention. And then there's a big thing, and then your gear's not working. And all of this stuff. There's so much that can go wrong. And all of that sort of bubbles up when you're just getting ready to prep for it, you know. And in the meantime, people are sort of emailing you and stuff and going, oh, can you do a phone? And you go, oh, I can't do a fucking phone. I'm not sleeping, you know. And so that tension is always there. It's always been there since day one, you know. And it's quite sparky. But I couldn't imagine doing it without having something like that. Without having that feeling, because I think that's the thing that keeps you sharp. I would hate to go on stage, I know I'm doing it now, but I would hate to go on stage with my bass and not be able to cut the mustard and perform when people go, you know, they're not as good as they were.
But presumably there's a moment when you think you've won the crowd, you've done it, you know.
Well, it's when the roar greets you.
And that must happen often, when you go on stage.
Yeah, that's so, it. And they're so pleased to see you. Yeah. And it is this lovely feeling of like, oh, yeah, now we're going to have the best time ever, you know.
Do you ever look out at the crowd and kind of connect with individuals? Or do you look at
the... I connect a lot. There's a lot of forehead in my audiences these days. our demographic is very dandruff-free, I would say.
See, I'm interested in this. Do you look at the people who are having a great time, or do you look at the odd one who might not appear to be having a great time and try to win them over?
Well, it never happens, David, but... I do, you know, of course that happens. There's always that thing, you know. And it's the same as, you know, like, you know, 100 people can tell you the best thing they've ever seen. And one person can say, well, you know, I thought the sound was horrible. And that's the one you just remember. That's the one that sort of sticks in your head, and the one that makes you go, ah, you know. Get a sound guy up here immediately.
Because musicians can be completely haunted by one person kind of walking out. They're probably just going to make a phone call or going to the Lewis.
Yeah.
And they can just be completely obsessed by the idea. What have I done? People are leaving.
I'll tell you, Mark, the thing that kills me more than anything are overzealous security people who say, you know, we're a dance band, you know, our music's dance oriented, and I want people to get up and dance, you know, sit down in the ballad, now get up again, here we go. But these people that sort of whiz around in high vis jackets going, sit down. And there was the last gig we did at the Apollo in 2016, the last of the UK tour. I recorded it, and there's this big bit where I'm going into Tehran. I'm saying, "No, you're all right, love." In the middle of a song, we're playing, and I'm going, "Hey, yeah, security lady." That's it. And I said, "No, they can dance. It's okay." Let them. And then I have to just say, "Go and get the tour manager." And it's so frustrating. Yes, I understand about health and safety and fire hazards, but she's a bloody fire hazard, walking up and down, dressed in cladding. You know,
didn't get any of that at the Caister weekend.
We're having a nice time.
Yeah.
that's the kind of the classic lineup of, you know, Level 42 when in the mid 80s when you had a load of hits and the Gould Brothers left.
Yeah, that was hard.
It must be really hard.
It was. It was really, really hard because it didn't just suddenly happen. There'd been this sort of breakdown of the fun of it all for the sort of preceding 2 years. And that sort of two-year period, as I've sort of found out latterly in life, is just always this amount of time it seems to take you from the moment you think, actually, there's something wrong here, to the moment it finishes, be that with a divorce or whatever, flipping Brexit, you know, this thing of you think, hang on, there's something not right here. That it's, you know, that the thrill is gone, as you know the blues player sang, and then it takes you that long because nobody wants to make a move, nobody wants to say anything, but you're still going out, you're still touring, you're working hard. In fact, we were working harder and harder and harder, which only compounded the problem really. And it's, I don't think any of us were old enough or mature enough to sit down and say, well, okay, look, you know, this is what's going on. We just never did it. We were all so heads down. And that's the thing, is because remember that you without taking a break, you start from that moment when we're all just rushing up to the Guildhall School of Music to practice on a Monday night, funky theme, going into a jazzy bit, number two, or whatever. And now suddenly, you know, you're playing, you know, 8 nights at Wembley Arena. And they're all sold out. And that's on the back of the fact you've just come out, you toured with Madonna, now you're flying over to Germany because you're number one in Germany. Then you've got to fly back over to Los Angeles to do some TV show there and stuff. And I remember that it got so bad with flights. I'm not scared of flying, but it depresses me that the amount of time you'd have to sit on an aeroplane for 13 hours. And then you do it, and then you think, well, after we've done the show tomorrow, I'm going to sit on another 13 hours. And it seemed like such a colossal waste of life. Of your time, you know. And there weren't the entertainments then, you know. There was one grainy film up the front that just used to sort of burble away. It was so... That was depressing. And I'm sure it's exactly what Boone felt and what Phil
felt. How did they announce they were leaving?
Yeah, go on. Well, Boone left first of all, actually. Phil had already been making noises. I mean, every time we had a meeting at the accountants, he said, I've just got to let you know this is... I'm off in 2 months. And he said it so often, it was the boy
you
cry
didn't
wolf.
Believe it.
No, we didn't. And so, you know, and because then we'd have the meeting in 6 months' time, and he'd go, right, that's it, I'm really off this time. And, you know, everyone was going, yeah, right, you know.
I've got to interrupt. I'll tell you a story about Bill Wyman. Bill Wyman told me this. When he decided to leave the Rolling Stones at the end of a tour, he said, count me out, I won't be here next time. 18 months later, they rang him up and said, rehearsals on Monday. He said, no, I've left. Really? I thought you were joking. You can't leave the Rolling Stones, you know what I mean? Yeah. There's no process of resignation, is there, you know?
No.
You don't have an annual review where people say, how's it going? Where do you want to be in 2 years' time? You know,
I see myself not in the Rolling Stones.
I played with Bill and his Rhythm Kings. We did a charity show, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, and Bill was so sweet because he... You know, he's the great Bill Wyman, and there's that whole history. And bearing in mind, 1963, that was the band I loved. You know, I wasn't so keen on the Beatles. And he came up and he went, Mark, I just got to say, he said that Lessons in Love was our song, we said, me and Mandy. And of course, that when he was going through this highly thing affair. Yeah, exactly. And he just said it was our song, Mark. You know, and he said, I just wanted to thank you for all the, you know, happy memories. And I'm like, hey, yeah.
Glad to be a part of it.
So, you know, as we refer, you referred to it earlier, you know, that when the Ghouls left, you got in Gary Husband and Alan Murphy, who we're looking at a picture of there right.
Yeah.
He played with Kate Bush and all kinds of people.
Everybody, Skritti Politti. Al was the go-to session guitarist, which is how he came to be in the band, actually, David. We were recording an album, Miraval, and Boone had left the band. Even though he was writing the songs for me, that was what was really great about the Staring at the Sun album, is because Boone had left, but that's all right. It's sort of, he just said, I can't do the live thing anymore. I just don't want to do it anymore.
Right.
But, you know, but here's some songs. And that was brilliant. So who do we get in? And we tried a couple of guitarists that didn't fit in. And Al Murphy came out just to do a session on one song, and he was so good. So great, and we got on so well. And I asked him. I said, can you recommend anybody out that have come out? I said, because I'm getting up against it here. We're off out again in 2 months. And he said, well, how about me, mate? How about me? And I said, what, seriously? And he said, yeah. He said, you know, I think his time had run out with Go West, so he'd left the Go West thing, and that was it. And we had the best 18 months, really. And I never knew that he had AIDS. He never, ever spoke about the fact that he was HIV positive. And he never spoke about his private life, you know, that he was gay. But he was, you know, he never, ever talked to me about it, you know. The nearest we got to it was when in a sort of walking through a duty-free in an airport one day. We were sort of stood at the perfume counter. And he said, and there was a picture of a lad on a perfume bottle, you know, on a pack. And he said, oh, he needs a good wash. And that was sort of that was the nearest I'd ever sort of got to the fact that, you know, Al was gay and stuff. And you know, not that it would have made any difference whatsoever at all, but the very fact that we didn't know that he was HIV positive, even though towards the end he was looking really, really poorly.
Yeah.
And it didn't occur to me. It's the same thing as, like, not saying to Phil, what's your problem then? What's this, that, and the other? I was so just sort of heads down. It's probably my own fault.
It's one of the things that we come up with again and again, and talking to musicians and word in your ear, is bands never talk.
No.
They never discuss anything. And the bigger an issue it is, the more guaranteed they are not to talk about it.
No, and they never bloody listen either. So it wouldn't matter if you said anything.
Yeah. But it just builds up and builds up and builds up until at one point it explodes, isn't it? I mean,
it just falls apart.
Yeah.
You know, there was no explosion with us. It was just like, well, that's it. You know, and then everybody else tried to make out that there was something worse. And I think that was the hardest part, was like then trying to sort of go on and say, well, no, I didn't, you know, all the things I've just said to you now, it didn't occur to me. And it just really didn't. But everyone's saying, but there must have been some real acrimony and this, that and the other. No, not really. Only now it suddenly occurred to me that actually, that turn 1985, Phil never spoke to me once. But, I was so, we were all in it together, all at the same time, all starting from nothing. And now suddenly here we are. And the only way you sort of get through it is to get your head down and get on with it, you know.
I've got a picture here of the group that you been in with Stuart Copeland and Adrian Belew. I mean, is that just because people like being in groups, you know?
Absolutely. Stuart sort of texted me 2 years ago, April 2 years ago. I said, hey, Mark, I want to cut a record in Milan. And, you know, and I just texted him. I said, yeah, you know, when do you want me there? And I was there 7 days later, and we spent 10 days in the studio. You know, I'm a massive Adrian Belew fan. He was fantastic. And meeting Vittorio Cosma, who was the producer come keyboard player. And Vittorio Cosma was the keyboard player in PFM.
We
recorded the album in the original PFM studio. So this is old 1970s, fantastic sort of look to the place. But I've known Stuart since 1986. We did a Wogan show together. One of the first Children in Need shows, actually. And he wanted to put together... He'd been asked by Terry to put together a super group that would sort of get people watching. So he invited me, and I got Nick Kershaw in to play guitar. We had Mark Brzezicki on drums from Big Country, and Rowan Atkinson on tambourine. Yeah, but Rowan, he was absolutely dead keen on it. You know, he loves his prog.
Big prog and quite a heavy metal.
He is. Yeah, it's absolute. So he was, you know, like it wasn't giving it the Mr. Bean face, but he was, because he was concentrating so hard and he was loving it, you know. And we played this song, I can't remember what it's called now, and it was great fun. And Stuart's always sort of had that in the back of his mind. So when he sort of wanted to put this Gizmodrome thing, because he just, you know, the way he puts it, Stuart's is so larger than life, you know, and is such a driving force. It's incredible. And I can see how he would have fallen out with Sting,
yes,
and, you know, and Andy Summers, and how that thing went. But when you're with Stuart, it's exactly the same thing. He's just being him. And that's what makes it great. And at the same time, it's the very thing that it almost destroys it as well. You know, it sort of starts pulling it apart.
Do you get asked to do things and you turn around and Stuart Copeland's there or Midge Ure's there or whatever, and you think, oh, the 80s, you know, that I'm bracketed with the 80s.
Well,
do you mind that?
I don't mind it at all, no, not in the slightest. I mean, I am, you know, that was my time. That was the period that I was doing stuff. You know, I think it would be odd if... you know, Connor Moccasin was to give me a shout and say, hey, Mark, could you come and ruin my record for me, you know, by slapping all over it for no fucking reason. That would be odd, you know. Or Christine and the Queens or something, you know, saying, Mark, just come and ruin this for us, will you? No, it's, you know, I'm on my time, and I know... But, you know, we wrote great songs too, and a great song's always going to be a great song. And, well, maybe not great songs, but we wrote some good songs.
And this is Richard Tate nonetheless. Well, that's recent tour. Is that?
Yeah. Well, this is us, Eternity Tour 2018.
I wanted to ask you a question about groups generally. That they all start off with three or four members and then end up with eight or nine.
Yeah, well, why is that? Well, I'll tell you why it is. One of the reasons is that there's, you know, I love playing the songs, I love playing the level songs, and then you get a sax player in, and the sax player sort of adds to it. So you do a couple of tours like that. And then you get to do something like with the Prince's Trust show, and you play, like, Slave to the Rhythm, and then you have this amazing brass in there too. And then just at the back of your mind, you think, oh, I'd love that. I'd love to have that, you know, on. And so we get Dan and Nicol in on trumpet and trombone to enhance Sean on saxophone. And it's a really big sound.
Right.
And there's that thing then of, like, it will seem odd sort of going away from it. Having said that, Mike and I, we did a thing for the BBC recently. We just went in, just the two of us, and played a couple of sort of acoustic versions. And that was really sweet as well, you know. So, I don't know. It's not because I want lots and lots of players on stage. It's just because it makes a really good sound.
Right.
And they're also good fun to be around.
Are you doing a lot of festivals in the last few years?
Yeah.
How do you find those?
Love it. I love festivals, you know. They're great to do. They're great because if you're on top of your game, you can pick up a lot of new fans at festivals. You know, we played Love Supreme this year, and... We went on just before Elvis Costello. And so, obviously, this is an unpartisan audience. A bit like tonight, everyone's here to see Mark Kermode. And, you know, but I'm winning you over. Come on. So, you know, if a band's really good, if the band's good, and that's the only thing really I care about, is that I want the band to cut the mustard on stage. I'm a musician, you know. I'm not the world's greatest songwriter. I'm certainly not the world's greatest singer. But I'm a musician, and so I will put on a good show, you know.
So you're about to tour in the UK.
Yeah, we're out on 2nd. We start in Glasgow on the 2nd of October. We finish at the Royal London Albert Hall, which I can't remember right. Yeah, the Royal Albert Hall in London on the 25th. And then the next night we're off in Heerlen in Holland, I think, and we got another 12 shows out there. And on it goes. And I'll...
Do you like being on the road?
Being on the road's all right. It's a bit like a boys' club because it's you know, it's not like it was when we started. We're not all in the back of a transit. You know, we have these very lovely tour buses, which are horrendously expensive, I have to say. But there's actually a method to the madness, because everybody gets there. The crew have a bus, we have a bus, and you know where everybody is all the time. You know, it must have been a nightmare. I always sort of have to think back to why band leaders like Miles Davis or Buddy Rich or, you know, Frank Sinatra, for example, were always such bullies. And that's because, could you imagine trying to get a band that size all to be in the same place the next night, you know, when they're all out of razzling and sort of knocking off the local wives and, you know, getting high on whatever it is they're doing, and then expect them to show up and do a gig. Well, you put everybody on the same bus, you know.
I remember Paul Crockford, your manager, saying in the lobby of a hotel in Los Angeles, standing there waiting for the band, he says, "What is it about the ability to play a musical instrument that is inconsistent with the ability to get from a room down into reception?"
Yeah, that sounds like him. That sounds like him. And you want to set him more like that. But he's lovely, by the way. You know, he suffered some poor health, you know, a few years back, but he's bounced back, and he's and we're still the very best of friends, which is lovely, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, look, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
And as we used to say on Whistle Test, good luck with the tour.
Yes.
Yeah, and when you're doing the next one, come back and tell us all about it. Yeah.
Thank
Ladies
you very
and gentlemen,
much,
Mark King.
Thank you. Thank you all.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.